We are really pleased to welcome Madhavi Sundar to the Berkman Center to talk about her new book. Madhavi is a professor of law at UC Davis School of Law and is a leading scholar of law and culture. And she has written a book, From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice. Welcome, Madhavi.
Thanks.
And the one thing I also forgot to mention, which I should have mentioned, is that there are books for sale in the back. So if you're interested in a copy, they're $25 each. And Madhavi will sign them afterwards as well. So
yes, and if he didn't mention them, I would have. Thanks so much to the Berkman Center, to Program Coordinator Amar Ashar for inviting me here to talk about this new book, which is fresh out from Yale University Press just a few months ago. And it's always a treat to come and connect with the fellows, the students here at Berkman, and all the rest of you, and especially what a treat on this bright fall day. We don't get the colors in California, so I'm really excited to be here right now. So my book raises a question of fundamentals, and it can't get more fundamental than this. What is intellectual property for? Scholarship on intellectual property assumes a mandate to incentivize the production of more inventions and copyrighted works embedded in goods, from iPads to R2D2s. Even the most trenchant critiques of the excesses of this law, of intellectual property law, take this normative goal as given. So when Judge Richard Posner goes on the warpath against software patents, as he has in recent months in response to the smartphone wars, his complaint is that IP is unnecessary and even counterproductive, where we don't need an additional incentive to create. His critique recalls those of the influential public domain movement a decade ago, which also worried that too many intellectual property rights would deserve this ultimate goal, which is intellectual productivity. So let's call this traditional approach the culture and efficiency model. Now, let me begin by saying that I believe that this critique is just as important today for our thinking on intellectual property as it was a decade ago. But in my new book, From Goods to a Good Life, Intellectual Property and Global Justice, I argue that it is also high time that we go beyond it. If we are to truly understand the deep connections between culture and human freedom today, we must recognize that intellectual property law implicates values, including but far beyond incentives. My book offers an alternate framework for intellectual property law, focused not on efficiency alone, but more broadly on promoting freedom. Make no mistake, copyright and patent laws do more than incentivize or disincentivize the creation of more goods. They fundamentally affect human freedom and the ability of all people everywhere to live a good life. My book calls for a deeper understanding of intellectual property and its broader social, cultural, and economic effects, including but beyond its effects on incentives alone. I argue that the fundamental failure of the dominant law and economic story of intellectual property has to do with information's role in cultural life and human flourishing. Culture is not just a set of inputs necessary for further innovation. Culture is the sphere in which individuals participate, create, share ideas, and enjoy life with others. Singing, dancing, sharing stories together, using our intellect to make new knowledge of the world. These activities are fundamentally what human freedom is for. Culture is also a means for engaging in meaningful work in today's knowledge economy and is an engine of economic development. It is odd that the area of law most closely focused on Dickens, Rowling, Star Trek, Lost, Gershwin, and Prince has been largely indifferent, however, to understanding these creative works and their relationship to society, and to that part of the academy that in fact seeks to understand these relations. The disciplines of cultural studies, sociology, philosophy, science and technology studies, and development studies offer theories of cultural production and human flourishing, of culture and human freedom, but their insights have been largely ignored for the elegant simplicity of the economic narrative of incentives. In my book, I bring cultural theory to bear on local and global conflicts reflected and related to intellectual property law. I find in the work of Habermas, Dewey, Sen, and Nussbaum valuable theories on the connections between culture and freedom that can aid us in both understanding and guiding intellectual property conflicts today. The dominant law and economic theory of intellectual property is premised on a thin theory of culture as commodities. But as my work, drawing on numerous social and cultural theorists shows, promoting culture is not just about creating more stuff or products, but facilitating critical processes of creative and social interaction that promote our humanity. I identify three central features of contemporary culture that law ought to recognize and promote. These are participation, shared meaning, and livelihood. Today, intellectual property rights, from copyrights to trademarks, can impede our ability to talk back to the given culture around us, as the names of properties from Barbie to Star Wars to Harry Potter are owned, as our also our abilities to tinker or play with these resources as they become increasingly under the control of copyright and trademark owners. Such laws, however, have profound social, cultural, and political implications. For Habermas, for example, widespread participation in the public sphere about issues from politics to culture itself is fundamental to promoting freedom and enlightenment. Uncoerced and democratic participation in cultural debates is both instrumental, promoting the critical thinking and innovation vital to a democracy, and intrinsically valuable. Habermas and Dewey also elaborate the role of culture in promoting mutual understanding and shared meaning across diverse peoples. Cultural works such as literature, art, music, and film provide both social glue and vehicles for understanding those different from ourselves. A law and economics scholar may value sharing instrumentally as how people create, but social theorists recognize its value intrinsically. Shared meaning is what binds us together. Indeed, there is no culture without shared meaning. Finally, I turn to recent work in development studies to elaborate connections between culture and livelihood. As Amartya Sen has elaborated, democratizing cultural production across the globe is of critical importance today as both an end of freedom, but also as a critical means of economic development. Power and resources today attend to those who can participate on fair terms in the knowledge economy, whether one's contributions are fine coffees from Ethiopia or software from Bangalore. My book argues that as we seek to promote free culture and sharing, we must also recognize the value of fair culture, in which more of the world's people can contribute on fair terms to our global culture. So to elaborate these broader themes about participation, shared meaning, and livelihood, let me offer you some stories from my book that connect these and help see how they go together. So the first story is of a man named Solomon Linda, who's pictured here at the far left. In the 1930s, Linda was the composer and lead singer of a musical group called the Original Evening Birds in South Africa. While he was living in a squalid Johannesburg hostel, in 1939, Linda composed a haunting melody that recalled his own childhood in the hinterlands, where he spent nights protecting cattle from lions in the jungle. The Original Evening Birds recorded the song and called it Mubube, which means lion in Zulu. Mubube became Africa's first pop hit. And let's see if you can recognize the song here. See if we can get our mouse to work. So I see the flash of recognition in your eyes and the swaying in the back row, too. Linda's record soon crossed the Atlantic, and it was reborn, first as Wimawe and later as The Lion Sleeps Tonight. In fact, throughout the course of the 20th century, the song was remade in nearly every decade, in the end more than 170 times, before it eventually found its way into the immensely popular and profitable movie by Disney, The Lion King. What's been called, in fact, the most famous melody ever to emerge out of Africa made millions for many, and especially for Americans, but not for the song's composer, Solomon Linda, who died destitute of a curable kidney disease at the age of 53. In recent years, and after the story of this injustice to Linda came to light, Disney shared an undisclosed settlement with Linda's children, who are pictured here. But the settlement came too late for Linda's daughter, Adelaide, who died as recently as 2001 of AIDS because she could not afford the costly antiretroviral medications that she needed to save her life. Another of Linda's children had died as a baby of malnutrition. Now, I share this story with you for three reasons. First, the story illustrates the value of free culture, participation, and sharing. Linda created Mbube by freely mixing the American jazz and syncopation that was coming from across the Atlantic in his day with his own South African traditions to create a melody that is truly timeless and globally appealing. At the same time, Linda's story also dramatically illustrates how free culture is not always fair culture. In the real world, cultural exchanges often take place in the presence of sharp differentials in power and knowledge. Third, Linda's tale tragically illustrates the interrelationship between intellectual property rights and other freedoms. Linda's failure in this case to be recognized and remunerated, to earn a fair livelihood for his contribution to our shared culture, in turn prevented him and later his family from having the resources they needed to save their own lives. Now, some of you will respond, this is a tragic story, but it's an old story. Apartheid is no longer. So let me share with you another more recent story, and this one, too, centers on The Lion King. When it premiered in 1994, The Lion King was billed as Disney's first original animated film, in contrast to Disney's earlier works, such as The Jungle Book and The Little Mermaid, which had been based on pre-existing works. But this was not, in fact, quite the truth. In fact, The Lion King is strikingly similar to an earlier animated work, Kimba the White Lion, by the master Japanese animator Osamu Tezuka. Kimba and the Lion King follow the same basic plot. An African emperor lion dies early, leaving a young cub. The son struggles with himself over his responsibilities to lead the animal kingdom. The son eventually returns from exile to overthrow the evil lion who has usurped power in his absence. Now, if this is all that The Lion King took, it would be just fine. Under American copyright law, as many of you in this room know, basic plot ideas are not copyrightable. Only original expressions of these ideas are. But here, too, The Lion King stumbles. To begin with, the names of the leading lion cubs are similar, Kimba and Simba. The evil lion in the Kimba the White Lion, Claw, is blind in one eye. The evil lion in The Lion King, Scar, has a scar across one eye. More compellingly, even nearly every animal character in Kimba the White Lion has an analog in The Lion King. So in both works, a baboon serves as the old sage, the henchmen for the evil lion are hyenas, and the Lion King's advisor is a parrot. And throughout The Lion King, there are numerous instances of nearly identical cinematic and artistic expression to Kimba. This likeness is particularly jarring where both Kimba's and Simba's deceased fathers come to them as a vision in the moon. So what's the moral of this story? Well, I would suggest that it's the same, ironically, as the moral in The Lion King itself. Intellectual property law should not be the law of the jungle. Free culture should not mean that the richest and strongest can take freely from the poor and the weak. A theory of intellectual property and global justice today ought to recognize multiple values, including not just concerns about efficient cultural production, but also concerns about participation, sharing, and livelihood. We need to ask not just how much culture is made, but who makes it? Who has access to it in the context of medications, for example? And who is making the money? So where does this leave us, particularly in contrast to the traditional critiques of IP that I mentioned at the start? Well, let me suggest this. Free culture is indeed important. In order to make new culture, we need to freely borrow from the culture that came before. Even more importantly, in order to be free, we need to have the ability to talk back to the culture around us. Kimba the White Lion was Osamu Tezuka's response to Disney's Bambi, and The Lion King was Disney's reply back. But free cannot be our only value. In addition to free, we must also think about fair. Global cultural exchanges must be made on ethical terms. This is increasingly important as individual and countries' wealth depend on their ability to contribute to our global cultural heritage in our knowledge economy. Sharing is important, not only because it's how we create, but because shared meaning is what binds us together. The beauty of The Lion Sleeps Tonight is it's a song that literally the whole world knows. At the same time, so too must we foster care for others. We need to care when poor creators in the developing world like Solomon Linda or Ethiopian coffee farmers are not earning a fair livelihood for their contributions to our shared culture. And we need to care when patents make life-saving drugs so costly that millions in the developing world die because they cannot buy them. Now, the language of care is not one we hear often when we discuss patents. We focus on hot cases like Apple v. Samsung, where values like innovation and competition hang in the balance. In Chapter 7 of my book, which is available for free download at msunder.com, I elaborate other social effects of patents. For millions of poor patients in Africa and other parts of the developing world every year, like Linda's daughter Adelaine, patents are not just inefficient, they are an issue of life or death. Let me turn now to my final story, which is really many stories within a story, and it's so that we can end on a bit of a lighter note. So here I offer the final case of Harry Potter fan communities to elaborate some of the ways, with more specifics, that the law, the dominant law and economic understanding of intellectual property fails to comprehend the plural values that are at stake in the field of cultural production and exchange. Few fictional works have challenged the boundaries between real and unreal as Harry Potter. The intangible fantasy world created by J.K. Rowling has found a new life in the real world, from the creation of fan fiction writing communities to a real-world Dumbledore's army of young people dedicated to upholding the values in the books, to an online version of the fictional newspaper of the wizarding world, The Daily Prophet, which is edited by children around the globe. Even the fictional pastime Quidditch has been brought to life, with dozens of real-world Quidditch teams at high schools and universities competing for the chance to win the Quidditch World Cup. Students run on the field with brooms between their legs, while human runners personify the enchanted snitch balls. One day, children may even get a Quidditch scholarship to college. Now, under current copyright law, these activities, however, may be illegal. Law and economic scholars recognize fair use, as in free use, only where there is market failure. A classic case for fair use is parody. When you're making fun of someone else's work, it's understandably difficult to get a license. But kids who inhabit the Potter universe, developing their own critical reading, writing, thinking, and social skills through it, are left in a legal gray zone because, rather than parody, their work is better understood as homage to the original works and their creators. Under the dominant approach, these kids should either get a license or cease and desist. Paradoxically, under this approach, expressions of love are more likely to be illegal than are critical works. Now, it may seem easy to dismiss these activities as frivolous, but I suggest that contemporary cultural theory recognizes value in such participatory engagement within cultural spheres and the fantasy worlds that we love. Education theorists increasingly understand play in the cultural universes that we love as new, quote, schools of political participation and skill, as John Stuart Mill once described local government. Studies show that elaborate play in imaginary cultural worlds facilitate critical thinking, creativity, sociability, and empathy. I suggest that a more interdisciplinary understanding of today's participatory culture, then, may get better guide considerations of copyright law and policy, including considerations of fair use, today than does traditional economic analysis alone. So I shared with you some of the stories from my book. Indeed, stories are the theme of the book. In each of my examples, we see creators responding to existing stories with their own. We value this cultural activity not because of the quantity of culture produced, but the quality. We value participation and engagement with others, efforts toward mutual understanding and shared meaning, the autonomy to tell one's own story and reply, and the ability to earn a decent living from this meaningful cultural work. So herein lies the deeper connection between culture and freedom. As Salman Rushdie has stated, quote, those who do not have the power over the story that dominates their lives, power to retell it, rethink it, deconstruct it, joke about it, and change it as times change, truly are powerless because they cannot think new thoughts. The capacity to critically engage in given cultural norms and to tell one's own story lies at the heart of social change and freedom itself. Let me conclude with this. Intellectual property is the law of innovation, but it is not only about authoring books and inventing tools. To paraphrase Foucault, modern man invents himself. An intellectual property law befitting the new participatory century must lift its gaze beyond the narrow goal of incentivizing the creation of more intellectual products to facilitating our ability to author our own lives. Thank you. I'd love to hear questions.
If you do ask a question, if you could identify yourself beforehand, that would be great.
Yeah, 2 minutes. Professor Michael Jones, UMass Lowell, enjoyed your presentation. The fair use doctrine is a little more expansive than just kind of the parity exception, but is there a sort of a call to arms in terms of the law, the legal system, in a sense, having to alter its value system from just an economic to what you call in terms of free culture? And what sort of changes, whether it's an expansion of the fair use doctrine or just a continuation of, say, the Creative Commons that the Berkman folks and the Stanford people have worked so diligently toward?
Sure. So I absolutely agree with you. And one important point to make is that our doctrines are not necessarily as out of whack as the theories that we employ to interpret those doctrines. So we can read the four-factor analysis of the fair use defense under copyright law in different ways. And one of the main points that I'm trying to make is that a narrow law and economic analysis that would only find fair use in instances of market failure, where we think either there are too many folks that you'd have to seek permission from, or it's a case like parody where it's inherently difficult to get permission from the owner, that only in those cases would fair use be justifiable. That is, I think, a problem and an unnecessarily narrow way of reading a much broader doctrine. So what I'm offering is an approach that says, look, we can actually understand broader values that we can promote through our doctrinal tools in the fair use context. In terms of other places where, the broader part of your question focusing on policy reforms that may come out of here, I talk a lot toward the end of the book in particular about patent law. And something I didn't get to go into detail here in the talk, but there I argue that there are very important critiques of the current international global patent system, which really changed fundamentally in 1995 with the establishment of the World Trade Order and the Agreement on Trade-Related Aspects of Intellectual Property, the TRIPS Agreement, which suddenly made it so that poor countries, which for years could choose whether they wanted to recognize patents in fundamental technologies like medicines or seeds, and often they chose not to recognize patents in these technologies in order to promote cheaper goods and greater access for their people. After 1995, countries around the world lost that freedom, that flexibility to determine their own patent laws, and this, of course, has had a profound impact on our the ability of the poor to access medicines and other essentials like food. And so there I'm arguing that, again, there have been some important reforms. There are exceptions, even within TRIPS, that a few countries have tried to use to their advantage, Thailand and Brazil, but there is an enormous political pressure against that. So, again, I'm trying to highlight that there is some flexibility in these exceptions to the TRIPS requirements, and some countries are creatively and boldly seeking to exert them, but we need to first know what the exceptions say better to understand that they're not, in fact, working outside the law, but within it, but also to empower them to stand up to the political pressure and to critique the political pressure on these countries. So those are two examples there. Other questions or comments? Yes.
Hi, my name is Jessica. I'm a 1L here. So just if you could go a little bit into the background, like with Solomon Linda, did he fight to try to recoup something from his successor? Like what avenues were available to him then? And
so he sold his rights for about $1 to a European company. And basically for most of his life and for most of his children's lives, they would hear their dad's song playing on the radio, but they weren't really aware of their rights in the song. So, and in fact, one of the things that's happened in light of this story being publicized in more recent years is lawyers and other social activists have gone into communities in South Africa to educate musicians and artists about their own intellectual property rights in their work, to empower them in negotiations. And this is there is a good and bad side to that, right? So I think it's important to educate people about what their rights are and to empower them in those negotiations where they're not walking in on an equal footing. And at the same time, I think public domain scholars are understandably concerned about the culture of more rights and an ownership culture that may emanate from this, and that's actually been a source of contention with some of the arguments I'm making here about how we need to broaden who has been included in our global understanding of authors and inventors, and some of the reasons why the poor and minorities in particular have fallen outside of those definitions.
Hi, my name's Ruha. I'm a fellow at Berkman, and I run an organization called Peace Tones that does exactly that. So we go into communities and the developing world and and run legal rights workshops for musicians to teach them about their rights. And what you brought up now is actually a very pertinent issue that we deal with when we try to straddle teaching artists their rights within the current copyright and IP system in general, but also teaching them that often it's to your benefit to ignore your rights. For example, putting your music up on YouTube exposes you to piracy and to all of those things, but it also gives you exposure in terms of publicity. So I do think your Salman Rushdie quote at the end is perfect, because the best thing you can do really is to give people the tools and the knowledge to make their own decisions and to choose between the various regimes that do exist. So I think it's perfect. Not really a question, just a statement.
Let me ask you a question, if I can. Do you find that the creators that you're working with, musicians in particular, that the existing laws, the framework about fixation and originality, that applies well to them? Do they have trouble comporting with the traditional requirements?
Could you elaborate?
So for example, I think that there is a meme that poor creators often create, you know, work in oral cultures, and they don't find modern Western intellectual property laws to be as conducive to the kind of creations that they make. But and they may also resist Western property ideas and commodification. So I'm curious to hear how your actual interactions with these musicians relates to those ideas. Are they actually much more favorably inclined toward propertization? Do they feel the laws work for them? They just didn't know about them?
Sure. So we work with musicians who are seeking to make an income off their music, which is one subsection of musicians, right? There are musicians for whom music is just a cultural practice, and it's not something that they need to monetize. And for those musicians, it's a completely different conversation, and those aren't the musicians we work with. We work with musicians who have fixed their music. They have CDs, and they're trying to get their music out there, but they have difficulty distributing and getting publicity because of a lack of of knowledge, and sometimes their music is out there and is being consumed, but they have a lack of knowledge about how to really monetize that. So it's on the radio, but they don't know about performance organizations that can collect for them. So definitely it's the musicians we deal with are a subsection of musicians in general.
Great.
I'm Lowell Schwartz from RAND. I'm doing quite a bit of work on cultural issues in the Middle East. And one of the things that we have found is, as we were just talking about, that artists have a very difficult time making a living because they can't sell their work, there aren't enough distribution points. And certainly one of the criticisms has been that they lack the kind of legally enforceable mechanisms, and therefore the whole infrastructure of the creative industries doesn't occur because there's no way to make money. How do you respond to that? Because our natural response is, in the United States, is, well, you can patent it, or you can, you know, intellectual property, so therefore you own it, which makes it a profitable venture for people to actually create works.
Well, obviously, the problem with getting a patent, that's just the beginning, and it's not going to get you anywhere if you can't enforce it, and it'll cost you at least $1 million to engage in the litigation required to enforcing the patent. So, and similarly, in the copyright context, we're talking about empowering people to understand their rights, to claim their rights, but then how do you actually then go and follow up and enforce to track down the folks who might be creating great new work out of there, but maybe, you know, there's a way to for you to kind of share in some of those revenues. How do you find those people? How do you pay the lawyers that you would need? And this is, I think, a really important lesson to the students in the room, because there's a lot of pro bono IP work that can be done here. And so you have top law firms around the country and the world volunteering their intelligence and their services to help Ethiopian coffee farmers, for example, in claiming trademark rights and the names of some of their specialty coffees and enforcing those rights against powerful players, including Starbucks. So I think that we need to develop, as we have already begun to do with enterprises like the Creative Commons and the EFF, more of a pro bono culture among IP lawyers that can help provide those services to underprivileged creators who now might recognize they have rights, might try to claim those rights, but can't actually effectively enforce them. So it's a really important question, and I think we aren't without the tools to be able to answer that as a collective group here of lawyers and future lawyers. Oh.
In certain instances, there's limited enforcement for patented medical procedures, which is very different than the pharmaceutical industry. So where is the balance? There's such extreme positions.
Yeah, well, our laws are not consistent. Point that's always brought up by developing countries in the international IP context is with respect to the protection of geographical indications. So geographical indications indicate where certain goods, especially food or wine products, come from. And there's a stark difference in the international laws where only the makers of wines and champagnes get extra protection in the law, and if you're making coffee or tea or folk art, that this receives lesser protection. So this is one of those examples where developing countries say, look, there isn't any reason except for the power differences of the negotiators for this discrepancy in the law, and you point out one too. And so one answer, which I think is understandably alarming, is that everybody should get heightened protection so that we have equality, so-called equality. So in the case you mentioned, should we then have patents in medical procedures? And I think this is the wrong way to go about it. Instead, we need to recognize that there are differences, and we can ask why. And part of the answer goes to going back to the fundamentals. What is the purpose of our law? What are the values we're trying to promote? One value is efficiency. As I said at the beginning, still an important value. So we can still ask, well, do you really need an incentive in the form of a 20-year patent, or more recently in the case of Apple v. Samsung, in the form of a 14-year design patent, to incentivize certain kinds of innovation, right? So Apple has a natural incentive to create a cool design. There are market incentives there. They don't necessarily need the additional incentive of the design patent. In the same case, we could talk about surgical procedures. So that would be one way of cabining the law. But we can also ask, and this is the question, this is the set of questions that does not get asked, right? But it is implicit. Why do we not protect surgical procedures? Because of the great importance to humanity here. And we think there are alternate mechanisms for incentivizing production, for rewarding creators, for providing livelihoods. And so if we're keeping our focus on that set of values, we can then tailor our policy, and that includes cabining IP laws to promote this plural plural results that we care about, not just efficiency alone. So thank you for your question. There is inconsistency, but that can actually help reveal to us some of the implicit values that we are actually have always been inherently recognizing that our theory doesn't acknowledge, or at least our dominant theory today doesn't acknowledge and should. The gentleman right there next to her.
Hi, Walter Toomey. I'm a lecturer at UMass Lowell. I enjoyed your talk. A quick question I had. I understood the points you made between the two animated films, The Lion King, and if there's an issue of infringement or a question along those lines. I understand the point you made there, but I was wondering what your perspective was when talking about the composer of the song. And I don't know the history, but you did mention that that person had sold his rights in the music.
Yeah.
And so I'm wondering, it seems like there's a difference between access to something like patent and enforcement that might be expensive and access to something like copyright that, at least in the United States, is fairly automatic. Whether or not you pursue it legally is a different story. But if you have those rights, mm-hmm. it seems like there's a difference between somebody allowing themselves to be exploited. If that person has sold his rights, what is it from your perspective that makes... It seems like the person using that stuff is sort of portrayed as a villain, that they've done something wrong by purchasing those rights. And if the bundle of rights that comes with a copyright includes the right to sell your rights, then how is it the composer of that song that may not have been popular or commercially viable at the time it was written is now what gives him more rights than mm-hmm. what he had to sell at the time? And why is it that he's entitled to more now that it's become a commercial success? And whose responsibility is it to police that? If a person, an artist, sells those rights for a dollar, as you said, or for virtually nothing, whose responsibility is it, from your perspective, to actually police that and enforce equality or equity in that system?
Sure. Lots of great questions there. The first point to make is, again, just merely educating people about their property rights, would the answer have been to tell Solomon Linda, you have a copyright here, but he could have ultimately sold it for just about the same amount of money. And even in the current context, when we are educating creators about their intellectual property rights, we still will see desperate exchanges, as Margaret Jane Raden has described in her literature on commodification and property, where just owning property doesn't necessarily empower, and it can in fact disempower the poor who will sell in ways that deny their own dignity. So, and this is in fact an important part of my critique of the free culture movement, because I argue that it's not in fact enough to just make a claim for free culture when in fact free culture in theory does not become free culture in fact for people who either one lack the capacity to create in the first place. This is a really important question in the context of the developing world. If you want to keep up in the knowledge economy, you need to have resources, you need to have money invested in university research and improved capacity in that context. So one, we don't have equal capacity to create. Two, when we do create, we don't have the power to negotiate freely and fairly in terms of our transactions. So I'm very much focused on focusing on these problems that interfere with the ability of the poor to negotiate. And so Is it going to solve everything? No, but I think that we need to recognize, and again, empowering people through having representatives that may strengthen them. I talk about this example where Ethiopian coffee farmers got the help of Washington, D.C. law firm to file for trademarks in the names of their specialty coffees. And when Starbucks tried to oppose them, Oxfam International stepped in. Oxfam is more well known for its efforts to fight hunger. And they saw a connection between ownership of trademarks and the ability to fight hunger in Ethiopia. What they did was they started a global shaming campaign where they exposed Starbucks' hypocritical role in trying to stop the Ethiopian farmers from kind of getting a little bit more of the money from the meaning of their coffee and not just from the raw material of the coffee beans, but they wanted to control the story of Ethiopia as the birthplace of coffee. Ethiopia's coffee is often described as black gold. So they wanted the trademark so they could control the brand value. And so here again, you have more empowered and knowledgeable lawyers coming in to represent them, but you also have organizations like Oxfam empowering them through shaming and other tactics like that to create a more equal playing field. So it's not necessarily at all the end of the story with just like having the legal right or and even learning about your legal right, but it's all of these various actors that can come together that can try to address the actual difficulty of enforcement, which is where I think many of the questions around here focused. So policing, the public can police. And this is one of the things about branding too, right? So the public is very much involved in making sure a company lives up to a particular name or claim to fair trade, et cetera. And so there is an important accountability issue there with respect to the public as well. Questions or...
Hi.
Hi.
I'm Ian Chaffer from UMass Law. I'm a student.
Great.
When answering Professor Aiken's question, you pointed to market incentives over mm-hmm. IP for patent and mm-hmm. innovators as enough of incentive, reason perhaps to pull back on IP protection mm. for patents. I'm wondering, though, with a less protection under IP would open up to competitive competitors in the marketplace and would take away some marketplace incentives. I'm wondering how you would reconcile that difference. It seems like we would be at risk at losing potential innovations and future patents.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we've always balanced our competing values, right? So we value competition in the marketplace because that promotes more ideas, that promotes more innovation, that promotes access, cheaper prices, et cetera. But we also recognize that in some cases, especially the kind of innovation that the patent laws reward are innovations that require some extra step, what we call not just novel but non-obvious invention, that there you might need an extra pull in the form of a patent incentive. So, but those are exceptional cases. The non-obviousness standard is a very high standard, which has been recently reaffirmed as a high standard by the U.S. Supreme Court. So the underlying assumption is that there is always day-to-day innovation through marketplace, fueled by marketplace competition, but there may be some industries or some contexts, like pharmaceuticals, for example, where it takes much more money to invest in creating breakthrough drugs and very little money to copy. So this is what Richard Posner calls the poster child industry for patents, because here we can clearly see the need for an additional incentive. But I warn that just thinking about where do we need incentives, how much incentive in order to create more, and to not have inefficient creativity should not be, it could be the beginning of our inquiry, but it should not be the end of our inquiry. Because now if the pharmaceutical industry is the poster child of patents, simply on the basis of incentives and the need for incentives there, we don't get to the other social questions about the impact of high prices in the poorest countries in the world, the impact of high prices on folks who need essential medicines just to live. So these are also important questions that we don't ask in all of our hot debates or enough when we, especially now when we're lured by Apple v. Samsung.
Hi, I'm Heidi Tvorak. I'm a lecturer in the history department at Harvard. So my question, being a historian, is going to be a historical one, and I actually work partially on the history of copyright and intellectual property.
Great.
And I was reading just the other day in the law library about the original Berne conventions, where the Haitian delegate raises exactly some of the points that you're talking about. So he asks that there should be no copyright on scientific articles for the very reason that Haitians should be able to play catch-up with Western countries, and is defeated, basically, by all mm-hmm. other countries who are at the convention. So the point being that these have been discussions that were occurring at the very creation of the copyright laws that we use today. The thing that I think is interesting, and that leads to my question, is that in discussing the creation of copyright law in 1842 in mm-hmm. England, or all the way up to the beginning of the turn of the 20th century, there were very different justifications. So one of the major justifications was John Locke's labor theory. That was very important in trying to think about mm-hmm. whether something should be assigned copyright or not. But another mm-hmm. very important aspect, there have been a couple of books on this, is the concept of public interest. So mm-hmm. in excluding, let's say, news of the day from the Berne Convention, public interest and the concept of public interest played a very large role. So that leads to my question of why do you think that there's been a move to this model of efficiency and incentives, and mm-hmm. when do you think that really occurred? And the second part of the question is whether you think that maybe a return to ideas of public interest and of labor theory might be one way of solving some of these problems. So going back to debates that were actually occurring at the very beginning of creation of these conventions, and they were very hotly debated around the turn of the 20th century.
Sure. Thank you so much for that. The earliest patent acts were so strongly focused on public interest that they had very broad language, as the historian here kindly reminds us, that said, look, we can have price controls whenever we want them, and in fact, we can break this patent if for any reason they are contrary to interests of the public or morality, etc. And so this is the kind of strong limiting language that the early patents were born with, and yet how is it that we came to understand patents as only in the modern day limited by this idea of incentives and efficiency? And I think it's actually the good news that it's very recent. That turn is really just with the birth of the law and economics movement. Maybe by the 1980s, you see the Supreme Court using this language as, say, a patent is, and using that language and to define trademark, to define copyright, to define trade secret, also in terms of efficiency. The good news is it's new, and we have hundreds of years of history in the trademark context, thousands of years of different understandings. I just organized a 2-day conference at UC Davis on brands, where we had wonderful papers presented by historians of trademark law, again showing the plural interests and values that were underlying these age-old laws, and so the question is, how did we move to a much more narrower interpretation, and what are the possibilities for broadening that today? So we see in 2007, the World Intellectual Property Organization called for a revolutionary change in our understanding of IP laws, arguing that IP law should not just promote efficiency, but it should promote development and human development in a broader sense, to look at issues like health, education, women's participation in the public sphere, et cetera. So part of that comes not just from understanding the history of IP law, which was always grounded in more broad values, but from modern discourse around what the purpose of IP should be for. IP should be to promote human development and freedom, not just to promote efficiency. And so these are current fights empowered by new theories of human flourishing and human development, and yet they are usefully, extremely usefully informed by the historical understandings, which were also much more plural than they have become in more recent decades. So I thank you for that history lesson and the question.
What you've stated so far, that IP hurts the poor more than it helps certain individuals or groups among them. And maybe we need as little IP law as possible, maybe we should be addressing the global inequities, economic and otherwise, in another manner rather than through IP. So that's a very provocative and general statement. I would just like your response to it.
Sure.
Thank you.
And the values that I am talking about here, I think, are not necessarily only addressed through intellectual property laws, right? So when we talk about enabling more people to create and learn and participate in their global cultural communities, if we talk about ensuring they have recognition for this, ensuring that there is fair remuneration for this, we have many important knowledge contributors, doctors, surgeons, university professors, teachers, who are not only rewarded or incentivized by the intellectual property system. So there are many tools outside of IP for promoting the broad values that I'm talking about, first of all. But then when we talk about intellectual property itself as a system, and I agree with you, we may be better off, and this is a fight that we can have, and we need to do more research on this. Are we better off without IP so that we can have rampant competition, generic drugs that are extremely cheap so everybody can afford them? I think in certain contexts, yes, we are definitely better off with that. But at the same time, we can recognize that IP can serve these values as well. In a world where we're not going to have no patents yet in the pharmaceutical industry, in a world where we do have IP, how can we infuse that law with these concerns and these values, and ensure that they are balanced in our case law and in our policy? So we're stuck with the system we have for now. We can critique it. We can call for reform. And yet at the same time, that doesn't mean that we should abdicate this hugely important space and tool to corporations as opposed to people, to everyday people.
So maybe if we have one last question.
I'm Eric Bendenterl. I'm a student at UMass Lowell. I was just curious, going along with the prescription drugs and the drug companies that you talked about, I was curious about what your opinions are about the length of the patent for a prescription drug. And since they're patented when they're created and they have to go through the FDA approval process, one of the arguments of the drug companies is that, you know, drugs are expensive because they have to recoup their losses in a shorter period of time. Do you think that the patent length and the process is acceptable for drugs and how they move to generics from the prescription drug company?
So I don't want to get into the details of how much is too much, I think these are important debates that we have had, we need to have more of. Now it's come up in the context of software patents, so the issue is, well, maybe do we need software patents at all? If we do, maybe they should be shorter, maybe they should be harder to get, and here you're asking, what's the right length, what's the optimal length of the patent in the pharmaceutical context, considering the investments that need to be recouped? I think those are important questions, but those are not necessarily the questions that I'm as concerned with. I'm concerned to say, even if you need a patent as an incentive, there are exceptions that we need to recognize beyond just, you know, well, you either don't need the incentive or do need the incentive, just like in the case of real property. In the case of real property, we know that, and people think of real property rights as much more absolute. So this is your rights in land, your rights to your physical property. We think of these rights as much more absolute than intellectual property rights, which historically have been limited in time and limited to only promote certain narrow public interests, okay? But even in the context of real property rights, we recognize that you don't have the right to discriminate on the basis of race when it comes to who you want to sell your property to. You don't have the right to prohibit folks from coming onto your land under your right to exclude if it means that they would provide medical help or attend to the health needs of people living on your property. You don't have the right as a property owner to interfere with other people's freedom unduly, other people's property interests unduly, other people's speech interests unduly, other people's health interests unduly. So I'm arguing, why don't we have the same kind of approach in the context of intellectual property, right? So intellectual property rights also need to be limited by interests, others' interests in freedom, health, education, speech, etc. Democracy, you know, what are the right rules we need here to promote democratic society? That includes the ability to talk about the cultural products around us that are shaping us. We need to talk back to them. So all of these are at play and very much so in the context of intellectual property, but we aren't grappling openly with those values. We do, I mean, in the context of copyright and trademark, for example, we do talk about speech concerns and the First Amendment. But we don't necessarily talk about the health interests and the educational interests and participatory interests, et cetera. So I'm trying to expand out what values come into that conversation, what it is that we're balancing at the end. And it's not always just innovation versus access. There's a lot more that hangs in the balance. And we do it in the context of real property. We can do it in the context of intellectual property, too.
Great. So I just wanted to thank Madhavi once again for joining us. And to remind folks that there are books for sale for $25 each, which I hear is cheaper than the Amazon price right in the back. And they will be signed if you'd like them to. And I think Madhavi will stick around for any additional questions.
Thanks.